The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
Good afternoon. I am Vina Jones Cox, and this is Real Life Real Estate Investing, where this week, as every week, we're bringing you the information and inspiration you need to start or grow your own real estate investing business. And congratulations to the 30 people who, when the dust settled, we discovered they had grabbed seats at the 2025 National Real Estate Investing Summit here in Cincinnati on October the 30th through November the 2nd. I think about half of those seats turned out to be virtual because we had folks from all over the country pledging last week, and a number of you said, yeah, I'll just watch it on Zoom and get the recordings later. The thing is, we thought we had hit the number 33, which is how many OREA donated, and we did not hit the number 33. We hit the number 30. So if you still want to grab those seats, you can go to wmkvfm.org. Scroll to the bottom of the page. It explains all about the event and the bonus that you get for making that pledge to public radio. And we will make sure that all the seats that OREA donated actually get gone. It was just literally, there were too many pieces of paper flying around here last week, and we thought we were there, and we were not there. Today is question and answer week, which is the week that you are the show. And the reason you are the show is because I came in here with absolutely nothing prepared. I'm just kind of waiting for y'all to send an email to vinoradio@gmail.com or call 877-772-9658, 877-772-9658. Note, Mike, that I just did that without a cheat sheet.
Wow.
I just said the phone number without a cheat sheet, 877-772-9658. I just decided to go all zen and let I knew the first numbers were 877 and just let my mouth take over.
Swimming in the deep end today.
and it worked. And I got the whole number out without looking at the page, 877-772-9658. Any question you have about finding deals, structuring deals, you know, whatever. Have a little patience with us today because I think Mike and I are the only ones in the station right now because everybody takes the week after Fun Drive off except apparently Mike. And we have Matt answering the phones. So there's kind of a volunteer answering the phones who's never answered the phones before. And if you happen to get dropped on the way between the phone and the board here, just call back. But hopefully he's got it figured out with his 2 minutes of training that he just got. Any questions that you have, you can send them to vinoradio@gmail.com or at 877-772-9658. And we're going to first go to the phones, I guess, and talk to Eleanor, who's on line one. Eleanor, welcome to Real Life Real Estate.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I am at that age where I am wanting to consider, like, what do I invest in as, like, a young professional. Everybody talks about real estate as in, like, private homes, but is there any insight you could give into, like, maybe investing in more, like, commercial real estate or how to maybe find another business partner? I think it's little bit daunting for everybody to think of just like go buy a house. And I was wondering if you had anything else. Like, we've started that bucket, but I don't think houses are the only investment out there, and would love some insight into some options.
Oh, Eleanor, I really hope you're coming to this summit on October the 30th through November the 2nd here in Cincinnati, because a big chunk of the discussion there is people coming in who do different things than residential real estate like you think about it. We've got some people who do, I mean, they do invest in true commercial. Like, they buy malls.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't get more commercial than that. There's no beds.
No.
There's no beds in that mall. And we've got some folks who like to do land, although they more, it's not true. Some of them invest in it, and then they actually rent out the land to somebody, like somebody who wants to put up a billboard, or somebody who wants to have a worm farm on the land, or somebody who wants to put their mobile home on your land. And there are definitely lots and lots and lots of options. Now, the question is, what scares you about owning houses? Like, what part of that are you going, I don't really want to do that because?
I think that it's twofold. I think the first part is, you're engaging in like a completely different real estate market than commercial, and you're kind of in this, like, I wouldn't want to, like, we talk about the economy and everything these days. There's a bunch of people that don't even have their first house. You know, I don't really want to be competing on the market with already having a house. I also like the idea of, you know, getting into commercial or land or something like that, because I'm like, you know, if I'm going for land as an example, I don't need to necessarily have some massive inspection done. There's not like a concern about maintenance being done by tenants. I'm not having to evict somebody on the property quite as often, hopefully, you know, like you hear horror stories.
Yeah.
From private landlords.
Yes. And a lot of those are because they didn't learn how to do what they needed to learn how to do in order to be in that business in the first place. And, you know, commercial owners also evict people. You've seen that.
They do.
Happen,
yes.
Right? Okay. So, but you're not, you wouldn't feel as bad about throwing out a Target as.
I wouldn't. Okay. I also wouldn't feel as bad about setting up a more firm business relationship with another business, if that makes sense. I would feel like two equals are kind of engaging in the same discussion, whereas I would be viewing residential property as a business, and that other person is maybe thinking of it as, you know, they're new to the city or they just graduated. You know, it's less informed people.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea of two equally informed people engaging in a transaction.
Can I ask you how old you are, Eleanor?
You're 29.
I was going to say, if you don't want to tell me, I'm going to guess you're under 30.
I am.
Because
yes.
you've grown up in a world where all the media and politicians and everybody beats up on residential owners, residential landlords.
Oh, yeah. I don't beat up on them. Yeah. I mean, I have family. Sorry, I'll let you continue.
Well, No. I'm not saying that you are. I'm saying that I talk to a lot of people under 30 who have that same sort of, I don't think I want to own, I don't think I want to be a landlord. And it's largely because everything they have seen or read or heard about, or, you know, the politicians are saying, we need to, you know, the reason rents are up is because greedy landlords, and that just whole, it's gone back to like landlords are Snidely Whiplash, which I just probably just completely lost you. You don't know who Snidely Whiplash is, but, evil guy twirling his mustache kind of person. And I think that's really interesting, because what is reflected out in the press and by people who are trying to grab headlines or votes or whatever is not the experience of most residential landlords. Like, I, you know, most of the people that I deal with are very intelligent. They actually like read the lease. If there's something in it they don't like, they say, I don't think I like this. Can we modify it? Or maybe I don't move in here. And you get the impression from the media, and this is what kind of annoys me the most about the media reports, you get the impression that, like, tenants are all idiots who just, like, they're just victims of whatever happens to them. And that just has not been my experience at all. And I think it's a shame because, you know, it's the individual landlords. It's the people who they own maybe like 1 to 10 properties. They're not hedge funds. Yeah. They're not out of state people. They're not zillionaires. It's just people who, like, I need to retire. And this seems like maybe in 30 years, these houses would be paid off and that'd be a good way to retire. We house literally 70% of the renters in the United States. And if your whole generation is going to be like, nope, not going to own anything, that means that those people still have to be housed. And that means they're probably going to be housed by Wall Street. And those,
I completely agree. I've also had the experience of being a renter. Mm-hmm. And I have had anything from, I would say, you know, a mom and pop landlord experience where, you know, I've known the landlord. It's not like going through some property manager, all the way up to corporate, you know, apartment complexes or something like that.
There's a different person in the office every month when you call, like that,
exactly.
That kind of...
yeah. And I think to me, like, I don't see that as being a, you know, some kind of moral issue necessarily, but I also like the idea that, like, with commercial real estate, it would be easier to draw the line and, like, maybe, and go in with, like, forming, like, a group of other people and buying something, if that makes sense.
Yeah, in fact.
Whereas going in with a group to buy a house, I don't know, but for some reason that just seems
don't do
more
that.
Difficult.
Don't go in with a group of people to buy a house. I've seen people do that. And of course, the problem is, you know, one of them gets up unhappy and the other four going, well, what do you want us to do? We agreed we were going to keep this forever. And now you want us to sell it because you want your money and we can't do that because we just can't, you know.
It's not just liquid. Yeah.
The commercial investments, and commercial, by the way, in the real estate lingo, commercial typically includes apartment buildings. Like one to four family mm-hmm. is, you know, more the residential side. And then once you get past four units, you're at least in the lending world, you're into commercial mm-hmm. loans once you get past four units. It is very typical that, so one of the guys who's coming to the summit, he's a commercial investor. At the moment, the property class he likes is, in fact, shopping malls. He feels like those are very undervalued. They've still got a lot of legs. Values are going up. And, commercial investor people are like, no, I'm going to buy whatever asset makes sense right now. They don't tend to be married to, well, I'm going to buy shopping malls for the rest of my life. If shopping malls get too expensive. Right.
Yes.
If shopping malls get too expensive, he sells his shopping malls and goes and buys trailer parks or self-storage units or something, you know, whatever helps him make sense. It's not like he goes in and takes down a $40 million shopping mall with his own money. That's not how that business works. There's usually some kind of what's called a fundraise or a private placement memorandum where that literally these folks will offer out, we need to raise $40 million. Your minimum investment is this. Here's how you qualify. Here's the rules. Here's what you're actually buying. And that's how they do it. So if you're just looking for something that's pretty passive,
mm-hmm.
where I'm just going to put my money in and there's normally not a guaranteed return in these things. There's like a projected return,
yeah.
mm-hmm. but things mm-hmm. can go wrong as things can go wrong in any investment. And literally you never lay eyes on the property. You don't have to manage, you don't have to do anything like that. The syndicator, that's the one who's finding the deal and raising the money, of course, is making quite a bit more money than the people who are just putting in the cash, because there's lots of cash in the world and there's not that many people who can go find those deals. So it's possible that what you eventually want to end up doing is being the syndicator. Like, I found the deal. I know how to run it. I got the education. I'll hire the management company who's going to negotiate the leases. And you guys bring in the money and you get a return of 8%, 12%, 14%, whatever it is.
Interesting.
It's an art, though. It's not an art. It's a science. You can learn how to do this. When you are looking at this kind of investment where somebody else is putting it together and they're, you know, giving you spreadsheets full of numbers and so on, being educated enough to understand what you're reading and have some sense about, okay, there is no way that a property in the middle of the desert that has been vacant for 15 years is going to be able to, I don't care how confident you are, you're not going to be able to pay this return that you say that you're going to pay. So yes, there is education for that. I mean, what a lot of people do if they want to get into commercial real estate in some way is they take what's called the CCIM classes. That's actually a designation that you can get, a commercial, something industrial manager, CCIM, look up CCIM.
I will.
They're not terribly inexpensive, but they're kind of the gold standard in terms of just understanding how these things are done and put together and funded and managed and traded around and all of that sort of thing. There's an even more passive way of doing this, and that is, you could, I mean, there's like companies that are traded on Wall Street that what they do is real estate, and you're basically buying shares in their companies. So like there's different levels of this, and I think you should pursue the thing you're interested in and care about. I basically used your statement about residential real estate to get up on my soapbox, and I apologize for that. I wasn't trying to talk you personally into buying residential real estate, but you know, start meeting some other investors and finding out what they're doing, and if they have investments that they need money for or need people for. I mean, I think that's the studying is great, but until you've talked to some people who've actually done it, and you really know them, and you feel like, okay, he's telling me the truth. He's not asking me for money. He's telling me the truth about how this went. It might be hard to kind of take that next step. There's a number of members of Cincinnati REIA, in fact, that are in commercial real estate in kind of a little bit of a smaller way. They're not buying shopping malls or giant self-storage centers. They're buying like single use commercial properties. Like, think about, there's a Wendy's, and the Wendy's leaves the property, and now there's just a building, and the building's for sale. And they might buy that.
Clearly for fast food.
Yeah. And we've got, although I've seen banks go into those, right? It used to be a restaurant and now it's a bank, but you got some risk there too, right? What if you buy it and nobody wants that location? It's only a single unit. So if you can't get a tenant, you're 100% upside down on that. And we've got people who do, laundromats, car washes, things like that. It's real estate, but it's a business in the real estate. So there's just so much to it. I'm glad you're interested, and I'm glad you're, asking questions about how might I get into this. But I think your next step is kind of meet some people who are already doing things, talk to them, see what feels like, that might be something I'd be interested in, and then go further in your education with that.
Yes, definitely. I think that for a lot of people, it's where to start, and that's the boat I'm in right now. I'm not even, I'm very aware that it's always a risk. Any investment is a risk. And also, I just think, it's like time in the market always beats timing the market. And I kind of feel that the earlier I can get started, the better it will work out.
You will never find a real estate investor in the world, no matter how successful they've been, who didn't say, "I wish I'd gotten started earlier."
Well, thank you so much.
I bought my first property at 22, and I wish I'd gotten started earlier.
Well, you have me beat.
All right, Eleanor, thank you for your very interesting call. This is Real Life Real Estate Investing. It's question and answer week. If you've got a question, give us a call at 877-772-9658 or send an email, vinoradio@gmail.com. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox. It's question and answer week on Real Life Real Estate Investing, which means whatever question you have, 877-772-9658 or send an email to vinaradio@gmail.com. A question here from SK, who always writes, I'm from middle of nowhere, Colorado. So first question is, I have seen some seriously overpriced properties purchased in 2022 through 2024 that are owned by owners who are way underwater or by banks, corporate REITs, etc. I know I can just make an offer and if they laugh at me, go on to the next house. But if they say, send us proof of funds, I say, what's next? So, and there's a parenthetical comment, don't actually have that, my actual self. Banks and any kind of corporate owners in particular are almost always going to insist on proof of funds. And what they mean by proof of funds is not necessarily cash. It can be a pre-approval letter from a hard money lender, a bank, a credit union, whatever. I ran across that an awful lot in 2007, 8, 9, 10, when it seemed like all I was buying or wholesaling was bank-owned properties. And I would literally, like, I would go out on Monday and I would look at, I pick a part of town and I go look at 15 houses and I would make offers on every single one of those 15 houses, no matter how much less I was offering versus what the asking price was. I think my record was there was a house that was for sale for $28,000 and I offered $100 for it because my attitude was, if I bothered to go out and see it and write down all the repairs and come up with an offer, I'm going to, by golly, make that offer. And that meant potentially having 15 different proof of funds letters twice a week, because I did that twice a week. I would go out on Monday and on Tuesday and make offers, and then I'd go out on Thursday and Friday I would make offers. Bought a lot of properties during that time from banks. So what I did was I had a private lender create a proof of funds letter that I could then, with her permission, edit so that it said, you know, blah, 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 lending, Vina Jones Cox is pre-approved for, and then I would put the amount that I had offered into the little fill in the blank, contingent on accepted offer and appraisal, blah, blah, blah. And then she put her name and her phone number on there. So that was important because I had a couple of agents who said, I'm not going to submit this offer. I don't know who this company is and I can't find them online. And I said, it is a private lender. She has proof of funds. Like, if you need to see a bank statement, she can provide one. And why don't you just call her up and ask? And that was what worked because, and it wasn't that I couldn't have gone. Well, first of all, I wasn't going to pay cash for these houses. So going to the bank every week and saying, hey, I need an updated proof of funds, an updated, let's tell these strangers how much money I have in the bank letter. I was going to get a loan if I was going to buy it. And honestly, I was probably going to wholesale it anyway. So it was going to be somebody else's money. But I had to overcome that same administrative thing that you're having to overcome. And I did it with a private lender, a hard money lender who has an actual website that people can Google and see that their lenders might even be a better choice. So you might want to find out who your local hard money lenders are. Find out if they will issue it's really a pre-approval. It's not proof of funds. And maybe use that. I don't want to, the other reason I didn't want to do a proof of funds, so my bank saying, hey, Vina has this much money in the bank, was because if I wanted to finance it, I didn't really want to offer cash, quote unquote. I wanted to have a financing contingency, and having a letter from a lender makes more sense with a financing contingency than a proof of funds letter. So, question from Shammy. The market in Tennessee keeps rising at least $5,000. It seems like every 2 weeks, any chance this market will start dropping? Well, Shammy, that is a very interesting statement because I have talked to a number of your fellow Tennesseans. Now, specifically, they are Nashvillians, so I don't know what you might be in a different part of Tennessee. And they are telling me a different story. They are telling me that at the top of the market, in the $1 million-plus price range, the market has kind of dropped dead. That stuff is just sitting and sitting and sitting and sitting on the market. And in the next step down, you can still sell stuff and you can still sell it for a little more than you did last year, but it's going to take a little while and it's not going to be a whole lot more than it would have sold for last year. So, you have a company name that seems to imply that you're actively in the real estate business. So I would ask you, if you're listening, to maybe tell me which segment of the market you're working in that you think it's going up so fast. Because I had a meeting last month with leaders of real estate groups from all over the country, like literally New Jersey to California, Florida to Michigan, like all over the place. And one of the things we were talking about is what is going on in the market. And the conclusion that we came to was that in most of our markets, there is still a certain price range where properties are moving pretty well, and it's not the same price range in all markets. In some places, it's the luxury market that's doing really well, like the top, that's called top 30%. That's not luxury, that's upper middle class to luxury. And in some places, it is deader than a doornail in that market. And yet, the starter homes, you know, starter home price ranges are going really well. I can tell you that investors all over the place are telling me that they are sitting on the sidelines, honestly, waiting for the same thing you're waiting for, which is they're waiting for prices to drop. They're waiting to be able to look in the MLS and go, oh, that looks like a good deal. And they're waiting for interest rates to drop, and they're waiting for more inventory to come on the market. And that's okay. So it's never a winning strategy to overpay for a property just because that's the best deal you can find. But it's also not a winning strategy to stay out of the market because you can't find anything. It's the good idea is go find stuff that does work. And if what you're looking at is entirely properties on the MLS, you might be seeing prices going up. You also need to be looking at days on the market, though. But I would suggest maybe off-market deals are probably something that you should be going after, because the sellers who need to sell and can't sell. So, like, I need to sell. I don't want to sell. It's not that it would be inconvenient for me to not sell. It's that I must sell, because if I don't, I don't know, the sheriff's going to sell my house for me, or this estate's never going to be settled, or the building folks are going to come and condemn my house. Like, I must sell. I'm getting divorced and I can't get away from my spouse unless I sell this property. I must sell. Those folks cannot wait the time that it takes now to sell a property, particularly if their house is not in nice move-in condition. So, of course, they're first going to go to a real estate agent, and they might list the property, and it might sit on the market for 3 months, and they don't really have that 3 months, so then they want to sell cheaper and just have it happen really fast. And that's where a lot of the deals are. I hope, Shammy, that you are coming to the National Summit, because four main things we're talking about there: how to find off-market deals, how to finance them without paying current interest rates, which, like, if you're paying 2% on interest on your mortgage The house is going to cash flow a lot better than it will at 6.5%. Doing value add things to the property, and also, as Eleanor just talked about, alternative assets. You can get a ticket for that probably still at wmkvfm.org down at the bottom of the page. Let's see. Oh, this is another question from SK that includes the first question. It came in later. I'm looking into co-housing and thought I could get an agreement in place for a lease and the use of a property as a business that would work as my favor. For now, I have none of the elements, property, funds, or organization to commit to a housing lease. Added to that, I wanted to make this affordable housing available to seniors, not assisted living or medical, just affordable independent living. Your suggestions would be welcome. Golly, SK, my suggestion would be start with some education, because with a business plan where you understand if I take over this house, the market says that I can rent each of these four bedrooms out to a senior for this much money, that's actually more in total than the house would normally rent for, because I'm providing dishes, towels, toilet paper, cable, electric, water, all of this sort of stuff. Then you could go to somebody with money and say, here's my business plan, and here's how it's going to be run, and here's what the income and expenses were going to be. And you could probably put together some kind of a partnership where you were running it and they were financing it. But, you know, key number one, I mean, I think it's a really great idea to provide this sort of independent living for seniors. I know a lot of people who do it, but key number one is you got to understand like the numbers and the requirements. And, you know, I know people who have independent living for seniors that is multi-story and has stairs. But when you get to a certain age, you then need to be finding ranch houses, right? And knowing that sort of thing and knowing what requirements are, like, you know, a lot of times if you're going to have group housing like this, you have to have hardwired smoke detectors, for instance. Do you belong to Cincinnati RIA? Because we have a focus group that talks about shared housing that meets every single month. And this would be, with them, would be a good place to start saying, okay, where do I learn about this for Colorado? So thank you for your question. We're going to take a quick break. It's question and answer week. 877-772-9658 or vinoradio@gmail.com.
Support comes from the Jardine Company, a residential property appraisal firm serving Ohio and Kentucky residents since 2005. John Jardine is a certified residential appraiser, FHA certified, and can help appraise a property's value if contesting the county's value assessment of a home. He also assists in estate planning to help determine what a home is worth if considering moving, downsizing, or settling an estate. John Jardine, certified appraiser, can be reached at 513-646-9822.
Just got two problems on the board right now, an accident Bridgetown at Ebenezer and a disabled 71 northbound at Smith Edwards. Weather forecast tonight, clear skies, low of 57, tomorrow sunny and 85, Friday sunny 86, 87 Saturday, 90 Sunday, and then we go back in the other direction next week. Right now it's 83 degrees. Stay tuned for Local 12 News for the news of the day and weather and traffic coming up at the top of the hour.
Support for WMKV comes from the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati, a nonprofit community of real estate investors with programs available for all levels of experience. More information about RIA and their meetings is available at 513-407-3137 or at CincinnatiREIA.com.
Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones-Cox. It's question and answer week. And we are going to go back to the email inbox since nobody has called at 877-772-9658. Question from Jim in Tennessee. Someone wants me to do a hard money loan in Ohio. how hard is it to foreclose in Ohio? Well, Jim, it isn't hard. It's like anywhere else. You fill out the you send the notices, you fill out the paperwork, you send it to the court, you get various dates where the other party can come in and say that they paid you the money, etc. I think the reason that a lot of people are less excited about doing hard money loans in Ohio is because of the length of time it takes to foreclose. We are a judicial foreclosure state. So to some extent, how long it takes is determined by how busy the foreclosure judge is. I've had it take, the last foreclosure I did in Ohio took 8 months. And the big chunk of that delay was not, it wasn't that anybody was declaring bankruptcy or showing up and saying, I deny that I owe this money. It was that week after week after week, the requests for the next step sat on the judge's desk and they didn't get signed. So that was a little frustrating. But of course, you are an attorney. You know how to build that sort of risk into your interest rate and points on your note. And, you know, we do have Cognovit notes here in Ohio for only for people who are using the loan for business purposes. So, like, you can swear out a judgment without even telling them that you're doing so. So there's some good things about it, but it's not as quick as it's going to be in a non-judicial foreclosure state like Georgia or Mississippi or, I suspect, Tennessee. It's also not as bad as it is in some of the northeastern states where I understand it can take, like, 2 years to get a foreclosure completed. I don't think there's anything particularly heinous about Ohio foreclosure law. Of course, you probably should talk to one of our local foreclosure attorneys and, of course, have some boots on the ground to make sure that the loan that you're making is on a property that is worth what these folks say it's worth and is going to cost what these folks say it is going to cost to fix it so that they don't run out of money. Appreciate the question, Jim. Let's see. Next up. Got a response from Shammy. Remember I said, hey, can you tell me what market segment you're working? And the answer was, I actually want to move to Tennessee from California, and I'm having a difficult time. And yes, I'm attending the event in Cincinnati. I work with Goodwin, and we'll be traveling with him. And Goodwin's from out in California/Arizona, depending on what time of year it is. I think Shammy, maybe find some houses you like that have been sitting on the market for a while and make an offer. Don't worry about, okay, they're asking $750,000, but they've been asking $750,000 for 9 months, and what I think it's worth is $650,000. Go ahead and make the offer. I'm afraid I'm going to offend the seller. Okay, well, you never met the seller before today. You, in fact, did not meet the seller today because there's two agents between you and the seller. If the seller chooses to be offended by you telling them at what price you would be happy to buy their house, then I think that's kind of up to them. That has nothing to do with you. All you've said is, I've seen your house, I love your house, and I love it at $650,000, not $750,000. I hope you have a good agent there in Tennessee who's looking for these kinds of opportunities for you and is not themselves going to say, well, I don't want to offend the other agent by making your offer. Because I think that's going to be your key right there. Appreciate your clarification of the question. It's asking if we needed to take another break, but apparently I ran so far past the first one that I only have to take two this time. Question from Catherine. To do a 1031 exchange, do you have to use a qualified intermediary, and how much do they charge? Great question, Catherine. I'm thinking that you listened to the show that Scott Ellsworth did with the 1031 exchange intermediary back in August. And by the way, this is probably a good time to remind everybody that you can listen to every show that has been done on Real Life Real Estate Investing here at WMKV going back, how long have we been here now?
Since 2006.
Decades, going back decades. It's going to be 20 years. So you can listen to that. You can listen to any of those at on Spotify, I understand, is where they live, or you can go to realliferealestate.com, and like they're all there, and they're all even categorized. If you put in, I want to hear the show about commercial real estate, it'll show you five or six shows about commercial real estate. I want to hear what John Heyer had to say. Just put in Heyer and it'll pop up a couple of shows that John Heyer has done. So, I just always, I think of it as a radio show, but it's also podcasts later on. So, to do a 1031 exchange, if you are doing a delayed exchange, if what you're doing is I'm selling the property today, and then I'm using that money to buy another property tomorrow or in 180 days. 180 days is how long you have to buy it. The money in the meantime has to be sitting with a qualified intermediary. You cannot have that money. And your agent can't have that money and your title company can't have that money unless your title company is acting as a qualified intermediary. That's the rules. How much do they charge? Well, that definitely depends, right? It's going to be anywhere from, I've seen as low as like $950, and I've seen as high as many thousands of dollars. I think the average is probably $1,200 to $1,500, but there's lots of qualified intermediaries around, and you can call them up and ask them what they charge and pick the one that you like best. Now, I said if what you're doing is I'm selling the property today, collecting the money, and then going out looking for a property, then that's a delayed exchange. That's not the only way to do exchanges. There's such a thing as a direct exchange where you find my property and you really like my property and you say to me, well, I need to sell my other property so that I have the money to buy yours. And I say, well, tell me about your other property. Maybe I like your property better than I like my property. And we can do like literally at the same closing, just trade deeds. And maybe there's some money involved. I did this once, and the property that I was selling, not really selling, exchanging, was worth quite a bit more than the one that I was buying, not really buying, exchanging. And so there was some cash that traded hands as well as the property. Okay, so you get my apartment building and I get your house and $20,000. And that was fine, although it's quite an adventure finding or explaining to the title company how that's going to work. They get very confused when you say, no, nobody's bringing any money. We're just each bringing a deed. And we're going to pay our own costs for title searches and transfer taxes and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, that's how exchanges used to be done before the Starker exchange that is the delayed exchange. And let's be honest, is very much easier. Rachel says, would love to hear the previous recordings from your show. Can you send me a link to Spotify? I've never used Spotify in my life. I just, whenever somebody says, well, where can I listen to the recording? I'm like, go to realliferealestate.com and they're all there. And on Spotify, it's probably under Real Life Real Estate, but I didn't set that up and I don't ever go there. And I don't listen to it there. But yeah, if you go to realliferealestate.com, you can find them all and download them and everything else. Okay. Let's see if there are other questions, because that was the most recent one. Okay, this is a, all right, so this is from V. No, that's not a pseudonym for me. Her name really is V. I've met her before. I have yet to do a subject two, but for the education, I'd like to know how one avoids triggering UBIT and the bank calling the loan due under subject two circumstances. No one addresses how to handle the prevention of this or what to do if the bank calls your loan. Oh, V. Okay, you asked this question more than a month ago, so I'm not going to sigh at you. Last week, when we talked about the National Real Estate Summit, the bonus for making the pledge to WMKV instead of OREA was a subject two class that I did last year that's about 5 hours worth of information. And not only do I address handling the prevention of the due on sale cause being called, I also give you like 8 things to do if it is called. So that is handled. I know probably on YouTube they don't do that, and TikTok they don't do that, and a 90-minute, hey, you should buy my course because subject twos are awesome video, they don't do that. And there might even be some subject two gurus who don't do that, but it's a known thing. It's not like anybody's trying to hide it from you. I just don't think you've looked in the right place yet. How do you handle prevention? How do you handle preventing the bank from calling the loan due? The reality is it just doesn't happen that often. And you mentioned the possibility that the bank doesn't know, or maybe they don't care because they're getting their money anyway. And yeah, all of those things are probably true. The thing that will make them care a lot is if you miss a payment or you let the insurance drop. At that point, they will definitely notice what happened, and they will likely call the loan due because now it has become a problem for them. Small banks are very likely to call loans due. I'm talking about the ones that are still servicing the loans within their own banks. And that's not most, you know, most loans, like you get it from the bank and then the bank sells it to a servicer and then the servicer just collects the payments. That's all they do. And, you know, what do they care whether somebody took it over or not, unless the investor bothers them about it? It's very uncommon. You will hear people say, oh, it happened to me. And I always say, okay, was it a small bank? And 90% of the time the answer is yes. And I say, yep, that's why you shouldn't take over loans from small banks. And if they say nope, I say, how did they find out? And they say, well, the insurance lapse. Like there's tends to be a reason most of the time. Your question about how to avoid triggering UBIT in a subject two is interesting, because the only time that buying a property subject to would trigger UBIT is if you bought it in a self-directed account of some sort, like an IRA or, well, an IRA. And the answer to how one avoids triggering UBIT by buying a property subject to is don't do it in your IRA. In your 401k, it wouldn't trigger UBIT, and personally, it wouldn't trigger UBIT. So, I think get a little more in-depth in that information that you're getting, V, because it definitely, like, I think you've got some misconceptions that are maybe keeping you from doing subject two deals at this point.
I looked it up on Spotify. You got to put real estate and Vina in it.
Oh.
If you put real estate, all kinds of things come up. So you got to put Vina on there.
Real estate and Vina. Okay, so Rachel, there you go. Go to Spotify, put in real estate and Vina, V-E-N-A. We'll be back next week with more information to put you on the path to financial independence through real estate investing. Until then, happy investing.